From a scruffy apartment in Brooklyn, this is the Bat Segundo Show. And now, your young roving correspondent, that dubious exemplar of journalism himself.
Thanks again, dear listeners, for your kind patronage of this show. I hope you'll pardon the sedate and needlessly sequenced music, but this particular show requires a clarification. I had arranged an interview with Katie Roife because I felt that she might be misunderstood. Miss Roife had laid down some interesting ideas over the years that had pissed more than a few people off, including the notion that women were primarily responsible for date rape in her tract, The Morning After. Extraordinary claims, of course, require extraordinary evidence, and it was because of this that I wanted to determine how much of Miss Roife's personal ideology influenced her views. Late in the interview, Miss Roife grew contentious when I asked a perfectly reasonable question and quoted a specific passage in her most recent book, Uncommon Arrangements, in relation to an affair initiated between Harry Andrews and Winifred Holtby, which can be found on pages 282 to 283 in the hardcover edition. I quote, "They slept together one spring when she had taken a cottage by the sea. This was entirely her doing. She had decided to abandon pride and convention and push their romantically charged friendship to a crisis. Well, Miss Roife at first denied that she had written this passage, until I found the page and showed it to her during the course of the interview. She then claimed that the meaning I had averred, that the woman is solely responsible for her sexual liaison, was wrong. Now, without passing the same judgment on Miss Roife that she appeared to cast upon me, I leave listeners to make up their own minds as to whether the phrase, this was entirely her doing, reflects an instance where Miss Roife's personal ideology influenced her scholarship. But then I'm not the one with the PhD.
Okay, so I am here with Katie Roife, the author of The Morning After and most recently Uncommon Arrangements. Katie, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Anyway, I wanted to first of all ask you, you write in the introduction that there's something majestic in witnessing the entire sweep of a marriage, but I'm wondering if this really is what we're witnessing in these chapters because you were relying a lot on journals and letters, and in the postscript you say, oh, how nice it would have been to be sort of this observer underneath the rafters or something along those lines. Does this really paint a complete story of these various marriages that you depict? Or?
Obviously, you can never go totally inside a relationship. Mm-hmm. And there's something, one of the reasons I was so attracted to the subject of marriage is that it is mysterious and that there is a kind of ineffable secrecy that we can never penetrate. So obviously, that said, these people actually recorded many, many more of their feelings, thoughts, and emotions and fleeting, you know, problems than most people do. So I think unlike these are certainly marriages that are less private than almost any marriages that we can think of today. And the fact that the people are obviously no longer alive gives you access to a lot of different angles. And I mean, I also approached these marriages looking at other people who knew these people's memoirs, at their children's, you know, observations. And so for me, the synthesizing the different points of view, I think you can come up with, you know, a portrait, and obviously not, you know, the single truth, because that is impossible. But I do think that what attracted me to this subject was getting as close as you can to getting inside marriages.
Mm-hmm. Well, to what degree did you sort of infer from a lot of these things? Because you're relying on other people's perspectives, and when you deal with something, sometimes you have differing accounts. Sometimes you have, you know, what one person calls, you know, blasphemous is perfectly okay by another person. I mean, how did you sort of corral these respective accounts?
No, it definitely was, as I say, an act of synthesis. So taking all the different points of view, and coming up with what I thought was an account of what happened. And always is an act of interpretation, like any act of interpretation. And what one of the things that I was the most valuable sources in many of these cases is something like Catherine Mansfield's journals and diaries and her letters. And to just sort of witness her point of view over time and combine it with her husband and, you know, consort's point of view as well, you do come out with, I think, a pretty you can see the movement of the relationship over time, and you do come out with a pretty clear narrative. Whether it's, you know, obviously everybody deludes themselves on some level, but one of the things I interest myself with in this book is exactly the mythologies that people tell themselves. Mm-hmm. What is the story that everybody is creating about their own relationships? And that's something that you actually can get by reading people's accounts. You know, what is their romanticizations? What is their story? What are they telling themselves as whatever is going on is going on?
Was Phyllis Rose's Parallel Lives sort of a muse for you on this? Or
yeah, that was one of the... I really love Phyllis Rose's Parallel Lives, and it's one of those books that definitely influenced me. I read it when I was a kid, and it really influenced my thinking about both about lives and my own life, and also about biography and the art of biography. And I would also say add to that Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians, which to me is like a classic in group biography. And I'm definitely very interested in the idea of a group portrait of another period.
Got you. I wanted to actually ask you about, you know, you avoided terms that we use in the 21st century like open marriage or polyamory or things like that. And I'm wondering, you know, why you didn't apply these, because inarguably, particularly in the Radcliffe Hall and the Vanessa Bell scenarios, that is kind of what the case is. And, you know, maybe this was kind of an early prototype of what came to be and what I saw so frequently in San Francisco. You can talk about why you called these progressive marriages or marriages a la mode.
I call these marriages a la mode, which was a sort of 20s term. And as I say, comes from the Dryden play, you know, Restoration comedy. And I used words like progressive and radical because that's the way these people would have been thinking and talking at the time. And for me, it's jarring when writing a historical narrative to impose our terms and our interpretations and a kind of post-70s sexual revolution idea on another period. I really wanted to come out with how these people thought about their own relationships and to use the language of the day. I think it would have been distracting. I mean, even other words I avoided are words like dysfunctional, you know, the kind of therapy talk that we now use to describe relationships. None of that really interests me. I wanted to keep the verisimilitude of the stories.
Well, you know, you have Von Armin's Secret Door. You have Bertrand Russell bicycling to avoid scandal for Philip Morrill. I mean, these are not exactly things that are actually out in the open. So, I mean, are these necessarily progressive marriages if they're kept and people aren't flaunting them? I mean, Radcliffe Hall, of course, was, you know, flaunting her.
Well, I mean, as you know, H.G. Wells wrote extensively about his open marriage at the time. And he very overtly discussed in his autobiographical writings his affairs and his open marriage as part of his progressive experiment in love. And he was pretty officially living in a kind of, you know, this anthropological pioneering experiment in life. And as did people like Vera Brittain writing about her semi-detached marriage. Many of the affairs were not totally out in the open, but they were out in the open. And that double way of living, I think, is always, you know, interesting. But certainly these people thought of themselves as progressive. And Vanessa Bell and you know, the Bloomsbury crowd thought of what they were doing as living experimentally, as throwing off the Victorian values, and they saw themselves in that way.
When you say not out in the open, but kind of out in the open, what do you mean by that? Do you mean by the letters that exist?
No, I mean, H.G. Wells was out in the open in the sense of, you know, as I say, he wrote autobiographically about his life. While he was alive, you know, detailing what he called his modus vivendi, his passades, his affairs, the different women he was involved with pretty explicitly. Other people were less open, like the Morells, about their affairs. And you know, the way this works in the different stories is different, obviously. But, you know, one thing I'm writing about is how these people were caught between the Victorian values they grew up with and the modern values of a new century. And they sort of bridged that gap in an interesting way and were conflicted by the different directions they were being pulled in. So there was an element of, you know, even in a household as open as Vanessa Bell's, a sort of Victorian tact, certain things that were not discussed, that type of thing. So I think there was a kind of a strange double way of living in many of these stories.
I'm wondering, is this why you chose, say, H.G. Wells over George Bernard Shaw, who was essentially his contemporary, and also railed against Victorian values in his own way with Mrs. Warren's Profession, but also had a very possibly unconsummated marriage with Charlotte? And I noticed that you actually just mentioned Charlotte Shaw in this. I'm wondering why Wells over Shaw, because of the, you know, situation with Rebecca West, or
You know, it's funny. There are so, once I started to write this book, there are so many figures that I could have included and didn't. I mean, there's Vita Sackville-West and Harold Nicholson are obvious ones. I could have written about Edith Wharton.
Yeah.
I could have written about Margaret Sanger. I could have written, and there were many different stories I considered, including George Bernard Shaw. But the reason I chose the ones I chose, in terms of Wells, I felt his story was particularly interesting because he wrote so much and so explicitly about it, and publicly. So he was one of the few people who wrote most publicly and most explicitly about his efforts to experiment in love. And so for me, he was sort of irresistible. Also, Rebecca West is a huge heroine of mine. So it's hard for me to resist any story in which she's a huge part.
But I guess, you know, the thing that surprised me about you not including Shaw in this book is because he had this marriage in which he stayed with his wife from marriage till her death, Charlotte. And essentially simultaneously, you know, carried on possibly affairs, depending on the accounts you read, as well as, you know, had this great sort of, you know, feminist outburst. And it seemed to me that Wells, yes, he did write publicly about these things, but I'm wondering if the personal lives, the degree to which people, I guess, went openly about these affairs, this was a kind of consideration for who you decided to include in the book?
It was really a matter of personal preference, as I say, which stories drew me in. In a way, a book like this is about intimacy. It's like these are the people you're going to live with for years of your life, so you choose them the way you'd choose your friends. Mm-hmm. And Wells is a particularly attractive figure. He also, because each of these stories that I write overlap, all the people knew each other and were interrelated. Wells is one of the key sort of central figures in terms of the map, if I were to draw a map of how these people knew each other.
Yeah.
He's socially more involved with the rest of my characters here than someone like Shaw. And so, you know, he had affairs with and flirtations with, you know, lots of the women I mention in the book. And so he was sort of irresistible also for that reason, because he's kind of central.
I'm wondering if class had much to do with your decision to throw Wells into this, because I mean, George Bernard, to go back to George Bernard Shaw, which I'm obviously fixated on, he grew up with a far poorer situation and was essentially self-taught.
Well, actually, Wells' mother was servant.
Yeah.
And he's a totally self-made man. So yeah. Wells grew up with a very, he was pretty much the least privileged background of anyone in the book.
Yeah,
And so I don't really see it as a class thing of who I chose. I mean, he ended up, you know, obviously making a vast fortune for himself.
But he began committing these affairs once he had made his fortune, once he had had this, you know, sort of house, this kind of privileged, existence that he, you know, constantly really...
Although he left his first wife for his second wife while he was still a, you know, impoverished biology teacher, so... You know, he kind of, I think he always was a charismatic figure, mysteriously.
But I'm wondering why, you know, keep it sort of with this interconnected aristocracy as opposed, I mean, was it just a matter of, like, making sure everybody's stories kind of mesh together?
Again, I really disagree with your calling it an interconnected aristocracy, in part because, as I say, Wells' family was servants. I think it was for the structure of the book, it was important to me that the stories overlap and the characters know each other and observe each other's lives and are involved in tangential ways in each other's stories. In part, just, you know, structurally, that's more of a, to me, satisfying way to read a book than if I chose stories that had nothing to do with each other.
Okay, well, let's talk about this, what you were referring to before in terms of, like, not wanting to, you know, have this sort of 70s, post sexual revolution sort of scenario up. I'm wondering why you chose the particular time period of between 1910 and 1939. The thing that sort of struck me about this was that the institution of marriage back then, it was not very easy to actually get a divorce back then. It was not until actually the Marriage Act of 1949 in which people were actually able to, like, you know, finally get divorces along the terms more or less how they are today. But it was extremely, expensive and very difficult. And until actually 1923, a woman couldn't even divorce a man. It had to be through this concept of criminal conversation. So I'm wondering, you know, are these terms really sort of, you know, comparable to today, given the fact that some of these people may very well have been trying to find creative sort of ways to sustain a marriage so that they could avoid this, you know, these clear limitations.
It's actually not my belief in most of these stories that most of these couples were interested in getting divorced. Certainly somebody like Jane Wells, who you would think would want to get a divorce, was actively interested in preserving her marriage at all costs. And I don't believe ever considered divorce. It was harder to get divorced then. I mean, obviously certain people like Edith Wharton did manage to get divorced. It was certainly possible. And in this bohemian sort of literary world, increasingly acceptable. I mean, people like Bertrand Russell, many of the figures I write about tangentially did get divorced.
And yes, you do have divorce trials. But
right, and there is, well, there's divorce. You know, H.G. Wells got divorced, you know, very early on, and with no money. But, and many figures, Frank Russell was divorced. Several of the people I write about were divorced at least one time, in Frank Russell's case, twice. I think the idea that you can dissolve your marriage more easily now does affect us. But I still think that the pull toward traditional ideas of marriage at that time is somewhat mirrored in our own times. I mean, I think that these things are not totally practical, that there is a kind of irrational longing for an intact traditional marriage that we still have today, in spite of the fact that it's easy to get divorced. I mean, obviously, one of the things is we live in a totally different time period, you know, after the sexual revolution. And yet what interests me is in certain ways how little things have changed. And, you know, as
are you talking specifically about marriage? Or?
Yeah, in terms of marriage and relationships. You know, I quote Vita Safra-West saying, you know, she thought that once women's lives were, you know, had sexual freedom before they were married and their lives were, in fact, glutted with freedom, is her word, they would be able to... they would be happier in their relationships. And so her idea, and many people at this time thought, you know, once we achieve total equality, our relationships will be happier, which I don't think has been true. And I think that in a way, some of the conflicts and some of the difficulties are more enduring and more entrenched, and in a way, beyond the reach of the kind of rational things like law, you know, or like political change.
Wait, but law clearly had to have some sort of bearing in terms of, like, you want to maintain your marriage because it's a little bit difficult back then, more so than it is today.
None of the people I specifically was writing about were contemplating divorce, or would have, I don't believe, would have gotten divorced had it been easier.
Then where are the parallels, I guess, between, you know, the notion of divorce then and the notion of divorce now? I mean, it just seems to me that sort of some of the things that occurred in these marriages a la mode largely occurred because, well, you know, the fabric of society back then was very much about keeping these marriages
together. A lot of these
together.
People didn't have to get married. I mean, Catherine Mansfield, sure, and John Middleton Murray is a good example. They didn't get married for a long time. Sure. D.H. Lawrence and his wife didn't get married for a long time. The idea of not getting married at all was very appealing to many of these couples, and many of them experimented with it. And so the idea that you'd live together without marriage, that you would stay together, you know, it was all a different, you know, they had a certain amount of freedom and they experimented with those ideas, obviously, with living with somebody you're not married to, sleeping with people you're not married to, all of that. So I don't think the idea of marriage was quite as constricting as you're trying to posit in many ways to these people. And obviously it has a huge imaginative force. What does it mean to get married? Why did Catherine Mansfield and John Middleton Murray get married at all? They didn't have to. Mm-hmm. Certainly nobody in their social circles would have blinked an eye if they didn't. They decided to, against the sort of logic of the experiment that they lived for a long time, for many years. And to me, you know, it's kind of more interesting why they did get married than why they stayed married. I mean, in a way, like, what would be the point of getting married in that situation? Why did D.H. Lawrence feel that he had to marry Frida? And, you know, in some ways, the endurance, as I say, of these conservative ideas is itself, to me, a more interesting question than why did they stay together, which is, you know, really about, you know, in each of these stories, a sort of different, in highly idiosyncratic individual tale.
Well, going to this idea again of these marriages a la mode as a progressive idea and them not particularly flaunting it, maybe we can direct this back to this idea of perhaps not just the divorce laws, but also just the idea of back in the early 20th century, people had a sort of, you know, obligation to maintain a marriage. It just looked good on paper. If you were a gentleman or even a woman of a certain age and you were not married, you were considered, you know, lesser in many ways than, you know, someone who was. You were expected to get married more so then than now. So I guess, do you think that this possibly caused these many of these authors to sort of, I guess, create these original sort of relationships and going and maybe.
I mean, I think you're overestimating our own times. I think most people feel very strange if they don't get married now. There's still an enormous amount of pressure in our culture, especially on women, to get married. And the idea that you're not married in your late 30s has obviously caused and spawned a great deal of, you know.
Mommy wars. Yeah.
Well, not just mommy wars, but everything. I mean, you know, Sex and the City. Why has Sex and the City become this big, you know, thing that we talk about? Because the idea of unmarried women in their late 30s is still shocking to us. Why does Bridget Jones have to get married at the end of Bridget Jones? Because we still live in a fundamentally conservative culture in which it is not any more okay for a young woman not to get married than it was in Jane Austen's period.
But yeah, Bridget Jones, though, this is a fictive construct. It doesn't necessarily mean...
It's fictive, but you I mean, talk to women in their 30s. Do they feel like they need to get married? Most of them do. There's definitely not an idea that it's totally okay to live your life unmarried in our culture, in our mainstream culture at large.
I don't know about that. I mean, it's a case-by-case basis in terms of the women I know, but that's just me. I mean, let's go to this Jane Austen idea. You actually mentioned in one of your previous books, in Last Night in Paradise, you wrote, "We long to reproduce the neatly trimmed rose gardens of Jane Austen's England, the lowered glances, flirtations, innuendos, and felicitous simplicities of the 19th century marriage plot." And you frequently refer to Jane Austen in this book and in this conversation. In fact, Austen's name came up more times in the text than it did in the index. But, you know, for example, you were talking about, you know, Elizabeth Vaughan Armin, and you say, like Jane Austen's character, she overpowered many men, but I don't know about that, because you have Emma Woodhouse basically playing matchmaker. I mean, what is, I guess, the relationship between this sort of fictive exemplar and just living one's existence and learning from the real world? Does fiction really matter that much? Does Jane Austen or, you know, culture really matter that much in the way that these people make these decisions about marriage?
You're totally misunderstanding my interest in Jane Austen. To me, it is interesting, as I point out, that these women, a lot of these women who lived very unconventionally themselves, had an enduring passion for Jane Austen. That Jane Austen should be, for Catherine Mansfield, for Elizabeth von Arnim, by the way, which is how you pronounce her name, and for somebody like Vanessa Bell, that they would live very experimentally and yet still maintain a passion for a fundamentally... you know, the kind of old-fashioned conservative marriage plot of a Jane Austen novel. And obviously Jane Austen is a much more complicated writer than that in many ways, but I'm not trying to say Jane Austen's fiction is changing the world. I'm just pointing out that what's interesting to me is the way in which our imaginations work. And again, as I say, my focus is on the stories we tell ourselves. And I think that there's always a tension between the experiment in the way these women were living and a more traditional, old-fashioned, straightforward, simple way of living. And I think that still plays itself out now in terms of the idea of Jane Austen, which is more what I'm talking about, and the experience of Jane Austen than versus how we're actually living our lives.
Okay. Well, you observed in a Salon interview with Rebecca Traister that you felt it was a really crazy idea for someone to tell their partner if they're attached to someone else or if they cheat. I mean, why is this so crazy given these limitations we were sort of talking about earlier upon marriage, given that, you know, people felt the need to, for whatever reason, whether, you know, divorce laws were a factor or not, they felt the need to preserve these marriages. You just were telling, like, none of these people really felt the need to get divorced. So.
Well, I think in most of these instances, the part where they narrate their affairs and attractions is the most incomprehensible, in that they did have this idea, if you talk about things, if you tell each other these things, it will save your marriage, which is also a sort of 70s idea as well, you know, one that we've picked up. In these instances, time after time, it's never really great for their relationships, these moments of, like, brutal honesty, especially in terms of, you know, I mean, if you look at John Middleton Murray writing to Catherine Mansfield, "I was attracted to this one, and then I kissed this one in a cab, and I kissed this one," and she wrote him this great telegram, which I loved, which was, "Be a man or, you know, stop writing to me," basically. And I think that, you know, her saying "be a man" was kind of saying, you know, why are you telling me about this? What is the sort of specific, exquisite cruelty of this act of description? And I think it's always more complicated. And I mean, this is obviously a matter of personal opinion. I tend to agree with John Updike's great quote that most marriages are ruined by too much communication. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I actually want to talk about Audeline Morrell. You rightly point out that Lynn Strachey, Virginia Woolf, and D.H. Lawrence essentially, you know, mocked her. And you also point out that, you know, she, you know, obviously they had these Thursdays going on at great financial, you know, peril that was not really announced until the last moment. And you also write of her sort of wildly romantic aestheticism. I'm wondering if it's possible that the theatricality of her is one of the things that, you know, really sort of motivated Bertrand Russell to actually carry on an affair with her. Whether this was sort of possibly, you know, antipodean or, you know, maybe it was a kind of flaunting that she actually offered that, you know, perhaps the Bloomsbury set did not care to do, because as you sort of observe in this book, even though they were sort of rebelling against the kind of Victorian and Dickensian sort of mores that were in existence with a lot of these relationships, they still fell into line into these sorts of family structures. So I'm wondering, since Audeline was more of a kind of misfit-ish kind of figure among, you know, she struck me at least in these various chapters as being a little bit different from the norm.
I'm not sure about that, in the sense that she was, as you know, the most aristocratic of the people I'm writing about, which of course gives you a little leeway. She was sort of in the tradition of eccentric British aristocracy in a way that I think made sense. She was certainly separate from the other people I was writing about in that she was connected more to the aristocracy and less to the literary world, naturally. I mean, she became a figure in the literary world, but that, you know, she wasn't really a writer or an artist. She was sort of really just a hostess. I do think that her romantic and kind of overdramatic presentation of herself and her houses did appeal to some of these people, because it did play out in a kind of material sense, some of the dramas that were more beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, her salon, which Virginia Woolf wrote really beautifully about, did reflect something, you know, in a kind of, you know, all the dress-up parties and the silks and the Turkish clothes and all of that, a kind of lushness and a kind of showiness and a kind of lavishness that was an expression of something that, you know, was going on in the kind of air, basically, for everybody else, mm-hmm. you know, who lived a little bit more plainly and more simply.
But I mean, it's at the same time, you know, she really kind of flaunted herself. Both of the Morrells did, you know, because you had the husband reciting his political, you know, speeches in front of these various people. And there was simultaneously this kind of element of respect near the end, but also mocking in all these various novels, not just exclusive to the people you mentioned, too, you know. I'm wondering if you feel that there was, you know, that this kind of strange dual nature had something to do with the way that these various other figures maintain their marriages and their relationships.
Well, I do. I mean, it is interesting to me how many of her guests turned against her, and that love-hate relation that most people did have with her, which does suggest something like what you're saying, which is that she's reflecting some, you know, deeper thing going on, because it is a little bit hard to understand why somebody fundamentally as harmless as Audeline Morrell attracted such vicious parodies and such nastiness on the part of even her closest friends.
Yeah. But nothing more to really sort of add on that. I mean, it just seems to me that there is a sort of expressiveness to her character that was not quite in the other sort of six chapters that I, you know, in this. She had a sort of larger-than-life thing, I mean, possibly with the exception of Catherine, perhaps, but, you know, I'm wondering why, I don't know, maybe you can go jump on from here.
Well, she certainly was a larger-than-life figure and very self-dramatizing. Although, you know, somebody like Vera Brittain, also extremely self-dramatizing, extremely larger-than-life. And someone like H.G. Wells, extremely self-dramatizing, extremely larger-than-life. I mean, a lot of the people I wrote about, I think, were quite flamboyant and colorful, you know, in their own ways, which is part of what attracted me to them. And, you know, for Audeline, I think because she wasn't an artist, her art was her life, you know, and her her love affairs and her houses and her parties and all that were her art. So everything gets poured into that in a way that, you know, a lot of the other people I'm writing about were also trying to create something.
I wanted to also kind of ask you about how your own kind of ideology factored into some of the decisions you made in terms of people to profile, actions and events and narratives in your way to actually include in this book. For example, you know, you have Adeline campaigning on behalf of Philip. You have she is nursing him during his madness. You have Jane Wells, of course, tending to her husband's business matters, while Rebecca West is essentially, you know, being told and barked what to do, as and also unable to actually cook for anything and having to scrape together, you know, sandwiches and the like, while, you know, Herbert George is sitting there like that. And you also depict a lot of, you know, strong women who are attracted to basically jerks and loafers. And, you know, for example, you know, Catherine Mansfield and John Murray, which we were talking about. This suggests to me, though, that some of the people you choose to highlight reflect some of the things you've written about in your other books. And I'm wondering, did you take any sort of steps to, I guess, inure yourself from being too easily influenced by these types of things? Or was it just a matter of a kind of, you know, just throwing yourself and embedding yourself in all the considerable books that you did to research this book?
It's funny. People have been, I think, slightly misreading this book in the sense of thinking that I'm portraying the men. I'm kind of apologizing for the men. I'm always seen as an apologist for men. I'm always writing things that are pleasing to men. That's kind of one of the lines of attack on my writing. And this book, I would think, is unlike that in the sense that the men come off quite badly. Mm-hmm. And that interpretation that I'm writing about, I'm kind of letting the men off easy, I think would be wrong in this case. I think if anything in this book, it's overcritical toward the men, more than undercritical toward them. In a way, really this came out of, as I say, an immersion in the stories. And I felt it was really important to me as writing this book that I approach it without any ideology. And when I say that, I mean, I really didn't want to see these relationships in terms of victims and aggressors. Mm-hmm. And in many of these cases, it's almost impossible to resist that idea. But to me, that's a really uninteresting way of looking at relationships. And I also think it's, as I say, I think I said, in each case where the man is monstrous, the woman has a hand in creating her own particular monster. And I think that that's true. I think that you, when two people are involved in a marriage, the dynamic is about both of them. And it's incredibly complicated and intricate and personal. And I guess that the commonality this has with my other books is I've always resisted the easy political way of describing a situation. And I'd always been more interested in what I think is a more complicated, intimate, personal narrative. And I think it's so tempting to look at things politically and to say, you know, to use these kind of this language that's offered to us, this kind of facile language. And to me, it's more interesting to go deeper and deeper and deeper into a more and more complicated personal dynamic.
Well, there's also a fundamental difference between steeping yourself in, you know, all these books and also relying a lot on empirical evidence, which various critics have attacked you for in the past for previous books.
For relying on empirical question.
The difference is that there's a fundamental difference, I suppose, in relying upon empirical evidence or, you know, what you sort of observe as opposed to what you actually read and track down in libraries.
All of my books I've read a lot and tracked a lot down in libraries. And all of my books I've relied on what I observe. So I don't know exactly if I understand your question.
Okay, well, I actually wanted to, for example, when Winifred Holtby has an affair with Harry Andrews, you write that it was entirely her doing. So a decision like that, I read this and I say, well, wait a minute, it takes two to kind of get involved with an affair. You know what I mean?
I don't think I said it was entirely. You'd have to give me the quote, but I never say it was entirely her doing.
Well, that's what I have.
You'll have to give me a quote on that, because that's certainly not in the book.
Well, I read that.
Okay.
I can find it right here. Let's take it.
Obviously he was involved in it. I mean that she created a life for herself. You know,
it's in reference to the cottage, and it's in reference to, you know, basically him going on and having a friend. You say that it's entirely her doing.
I didn't say it was entirely her doing. She was the more, in terms of the sexual side of the affair, she was more, she took the initiative more than he did, which is something that she explicitly discusses.
Yeah, see, this was entirely her doing after you, you know, described this affair right here. This was entirely her doing.
Oh, it's entirely, I said, his black moods, he doesn't want me. They slept together one spring when she had taken a cottage. It's entirely doing. She had decided, and then the rest of the sentence is, she had decided to abandon pride and convention and push their romantically charged friendship to crisis. What I mean is, she was the one who pushed it to the crisis. He didn't push it to the crisis. It was her doing that she had created the situation for herself.
Do you think that...
Obviously, two people are involved in a sexual relationship. That's kind of a banal point, if that's the point you're trying
to make. Well, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is by me reading, misreading this, or possibly, you know, you're...
You have to look at the second half of the sentence, I think, when you're reading a sentence.
No, but if I see this was entirely her doing after, like,
colon,
you know, they had slept
and what
together...
what I say is, colon, you have to read the rest of the sentence.
Well...
I mean, this is, like, the way people read that's kind of maddening when you take something totally out of context like that. You have to look at the whole sentence. At least look at an entire sentence.
Well, when I write a sentence, this was entirely her doing after they slept together, this was entirely
colon,
her doing.
Colon, there's a whole other part of the sentence.
Well, okay. Do you think that this kind of sort of,
anyway,
guess...
Anyway, I'm actually out of time. You could have one more question.
Well, I want to actually ask you a question about the morning after.
Okay.
If we revisit that, do you still feel that the word survivor is bandied about too much in relation to date rape? And if the term survivor is still unacceptable to you, how do you expect someone to cope with a legitimate psychological grievance?
I'm actually interested in talking about this book and not my previous work. But yes, I stand by everything that I said at the time that I wrote that book.
Okay. I mean, you know, doesn't your ideology change in any manner?
As I say, I stand behind everything I wrote in this book, and I'm right now interested in talking about uncommon arrangements.
Okay. Well, you know what? It was a pleasure chatting with you, Katie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So you said that only proves that I've been saved.